Hey, Sens fans, this is Stuntman Stu, and you're listening to the Sixth Sense Podcast.
Welcome back, Sense fans. It's Wednesday, December 22nd. My name is Graham. I'm back in the box with Francois, and this is your Sixth Sense podcast. Francois, judging by the grin on your face, you're either done your Christmas shopping or you're kind of relishing what's going on with the Senators these days.
Well, I am finished my Christmas shopping, and I just want to say, first of all, it's good to be back here and buckled up with you in the booth talking about the Sens. This is just, I mean, what can you say? Friday night, I was watching the Colorado-Ottawa game. Enjoying a nice cigar at the Hilton Cigar Lounge. And, it was great comedy. Watching, it almost looked like pond hockey.
I couldn't watch the game on Friday because I was in Montreal attending a friend's birthday party. So I was MIA. I could only do check-ins via Twitter to find out what the score was.
Yeah, well, it almost seemed like it wasn't actually Brian Elliott who was in nets. They just put sort of one of those plastic tarps that you can put on a street hockey net with like the open corners and the five hole.
Or
and
like,
Colorado was just picking the,
or it
the
was
targets.
Like the tie that they used to hang up whenever Ray Emery would go MIA in practice, so they'd have to hang that up in nets instead. They didn't have a backup goalie.
Yeah, safe to say Brian Elliott has not played his best hockey for this team so far. And we discussed this, I think, last week. The other guy, I'm not even going to refer to him by name, just the other guy, he's not in shape. So what are we going to do, man?
He's almost chronically injured. Corey Kluson was actually at practice this morning at the Bell Scienceplex, and he was wondering whether or not Pascal's groin injuries were chronic. It's gotten to the point where it's just laughable.
Didn't they get one of these hyperbaric chambers? I mean, we saw. Remember that the feature in one of the intermissions during one of the Sens games was this like brand new hyperbaric chamber / the healing spa and whatnot,
where they can do like aqua therapy.
Yeah. So I mean, what's going on here? I mean, the other guy, he's always hurt. They have all the services at his disposal.
Maybe they just have to take like precautionary measures with Pascal, put some floaties on those wings, and then just
what
let
wings? Guy's probably got 11-inch arms, man.
So,
it hasn't been good. Washington game was another just total collapse.
It's gotten to the point where you can pretty much predict how these games are going to unravel for the Senators, though. It's these third period collapses. Even when they have a lead, there's one goal, two goals, doesn't matter.
They can play really, they play actually competitively with just about anyone in the league for two periods. Now, it's not necessarily always a steady block of two periods, but I would say for about 45 minutes a game, and there are periods, say, in between there. But for a total amount of about 45 minutes a game, they can play with just about anyone in the league. The problem is there's that 15 minutes there, and it may be 5 minutes in the first period, 3 minutes in the second period, where they get totally outclassed. And that usually ends up being the turning point of the game. We saw it in the Washington game. Phillips decides to, be a little bit soft on his stick. And we all knew at that point exactly what was going to happen in that game. The wheels fall off the wagon. And the train's heading off the cliff once again.
I think the highlight of the past 2 weeks was the Atlanta game, where I received a phone call after Brian Little scored off the Jason Spezza turnover at the blue line. And it was you. And I picked up the phone, and all I hear is, click. And that was it. You just laughed.
Well, two reasons. Number one is, when things have gotten this bad, what else are you supposed to do to prevent yourself from going absolutely nuts over this team? And the other thing was, I thought this whole Brian Murray scratching shit down on his pad of paper was hilarious. Not as funny as the Muckler water bottle moment, but it was up there as a Brian Murray sort of press box moment.
No, I agree. Laughter is a great coping mechanism for what is going on with the Senators these days. And I'm hoping that these Pierre Maguire rumors that he actually wants a job is part of this coping mechanism that we can laugh about it and say, ha, no fucking way in hell that's going to happen here in Ottawa. No way.
Oh, man.
I can't even fathom what would happen if that guy got the job. But the fact that he's openly campaigning for it, or for any Canadian GM job right now, is kind of...
It seems like Sutter is fairly well entrenched in Calgary for some reason, so seems like the only team that might potentially have an opening is Ottawa. So when he's saying a Canadian GM job, like, what other team could possibly have an opening right now?
I think you're limited down to Calgary and Ottawa.
Yeah. But, I mean, it seems like Sutter is...
Well, even then, I've heard rumors of the assistant general manager, Jay Feaster, the old Tampa Bay GM. His name has kind of surfaced as a potential successor in Calgary. And, yeah, if that's the case, then it looks like the meal ticket if McGuire is actually going to get his fair shake. And I believe he was on Team 1200 this morning, actually, and he said he's had opportunities to take over a team's management, and he's passed it up.
I guess the only thing you have to hope...
Are you kind of nervous at this point?
Can things get worse if we bring in Pierre? Can they really get worse?
I think he's coming into a cozy situation if he actually inherited it. Well, any
successor, it's kind of like... I mean, Iserman walked into just about the best situation anyone can possibly walk into for a new GM starting with... a new team. Ottawa's not a terrible situation.
Well, they have some cap space coming off the books at the end of the year. They do have a goaltender. They have some defensemen in the system. Knock on wood that they pan out. There are some hidden boomer bust prospects.
I'm not going to lie. I am concerned about the prospects of someone who's been in the broadcast industry for a fair amount of time now coming in and being the general manager of this team. That being said...
"Quote unquote, the new NHL."
The new NHL.
No, I mean that.
That being said, hopefully someone who has observed the game from the outside looking in terms of witnessing a shitload of bad contracts being signed, failed sort of rebuilding strategies and whatnot. You would think that someone like that coming into a situation, and I would think he would have be fairly in tune with the fan base. He knows kind of what situation he'd be going into. So you'd hope that someone like that would surround himself with the right people to complement
whatever shortcomings
he would have, especially from a business acumen standpoint.
And I think that's my biggest concern, because I think there are many great scouts around the National Hockey League, but they wouldn't necessarily translate into a great general manager. There's more that goes into being a GM than just being a good talent evaluator or someone who has enthusiasm for some of the greatest young players in the world. But yeah, Pierre has connections. He's kind of adhered, at least publicly, he's always kind of echoed what the Chicago Blackhawks have done as a franchise. So I guess from that standpoint, I wouldn't have a problem if that's the kind of direction that he'd want to go in. But I don't know if I'd embrace it.
I think you could do worse. I really think you could do worse. Would it be the best? Provided he surrounded himself with the right people, it might work out all right. But financial considerations have become very important given the current state of the NHL with salary caps, even though the salary cap's a total joke right now anyways. But in all fairness to Pierre, having listened to him quite a bit on the morning show sometimes, three guys on the radio on 1200, he's always been pretty spot on in terms of his evaluation of Senators prospects. I remember when Brian Elliott first started playing a fair amount of games, and he was always kind of politically saying, well, don't get too excited about this guy. Like, he's okay, but he's not the type of goaltender you build a team around. And I think we can say that he was fairly bang on about that. And he's been pretty accurate in his assessment of a lot of other players on our roster, especially young players. So
he's also been very candid with his comments regarding Corey Clouston's decision to use Sergei Gonchar on the left point as opposed to the right point on the power play.
Yeah.
And he's been very critical of that. I guess, well, he's been adamant about putting players in a position to be successful, and I don't know if Clouston or the coaching staff have necessarily done that consistently during the course of their tenure here in Ottawa.
This business about just changing the lines up over and over and over again. I'm sorry, man. Hockey's a team sport, and maybe more so than other team sports. It requires a high level of chemistry, anticipation. When you're getting your line mates switched up...
But is that a personnel issue? Like, we went through this last week on the podcast. Is that a personnel issue, or is that a coaching issue? It's kind of a chicken and an egg argument, right? Is it the personnel, is the coaching.
Yeah. I think it's gotten so bad that you and I are both struggling to really identify where to start, right?
Well, I think you can look at a number of reasons. Like, the warning signs were there. We get into this every week. It seems like we're just like a broken record talking about the same things every week.
It's depressing.
They're old. They're regressing. A lot of major players are coming off significant injuries.
Okay.
A lot of players have max dollar contracts, and they're not outperforming the value of their contracts. Yeah. Our goaltending is absolutely anemic right now. Can't stop a puck. I think Brian Elliott's save percentage is like 800 right now, which is good if you're a soccer netminder.
He's a total sieve.
It's, yeah.
But that's, I mean, you know, you and I have known each other for a long time. We've had great conversations, even before this podcast started. And the Brian, it's always been like, I've always said, this guy cannot do it under pressure. He just can't. He's a decent backup, but I mean, come on. And the thing is, it's frustrating because you can look at a number of goals he gives up and be like, you can rationalize it to not being his fault. But the bottom line is, if this guy is going to be a legit NHL goaltender, he's just got to make some saves. Even if they are good goals, like you got to be able to depend on the guy to make some saves, especially when you're ahead. And that was the issue when we were in the Cup Finals against Anaheim with Emery. It was kind of the same deal. Whenever we were tied or a goal ahead, he couldn't make a save to keep us ahead or keep us tied. He'd make tons of terrific saves when we were down a goal or two to keep us in the game, but he could never bail us out when we needed him most to sort of... You have those moments, those lulls where you're getting the play taken to you, and it's going to happen. It happens to every team. And you need the goaltender to backstop you and to sort of be that guy that you can lean on when things aren't going entirely well until you can get sort of your game going again and get back in the flow of the game. Elliott can't do that. Can't do that. We've seen him for 3 years now. He can't do it.
I think a lot of fans would argue that we've never really had that.
Hasek. We've had it with Hasek
for half a season.
Yeah, exactly. And that was the Olympic year, and that's all she wrote.
So we've kind of struggled to find the words of like how disappointed we are as Sens fans in the sense that this team doesn't seem to have a lot of direction. You don't really know if they're going to publicly acknowledge soon whether or not they're out of it and whether or not they're going to be buyers or sellers, whether they're going to retool, rebuild, try and keep this team competitive on a year-to-year basis. And one of the things I've noticed lately is that Eugene Melnyk has kind of been conspicuously absent with his public comments. I don't think I've heard anything from him since his infamous buckle up comments made in, what, the middle of November?
I kind of...
Are you a little concerned about this?
Well, other than the fact that I'm like dying for some Eugene Melnyk related comedy to come out of this, I guess I'm concerned in the sense that maybe he's plotting what he's going to do. This is right about that time of the year where he would have come out and made some comment along the lines of, I am supremely confident that in the management and in the coach, like he did when right before Hartsburg got turfed. Melnyk's been kind of laying in the weeds right now, so maybe he's going to let everyone enjoy their Christmas break and then bring the hammer of God in January. Who knows?
So are you a little bit nervous of what he's going to do or what he has planned?
The only person who can fire Kloosten is Melnyk, because if Murray fires Kloosten, Murray's going to have to go behind the bench. There's no way Melnyk's going to let him hire an interim coach.
Oh, you'd hope not.
I don't think Murray wants to go behind the bench. So then I think you're in a situation where both of them see it through till the end of the year, and then we'll see what happens. Or you're in a situation where Melnyk cleans house, and who knows, maybe he names an interim GM, maybe not. I have no idea. But I will agree with you that the absence of the Melnyk sound bites as of late might be an indication that he's thinking about what he's going to do.
And maybe that's why we're seeing so many like camera pans on television of Brian Murray scribbling away in his luxury suite. Maybe he's working on the old resume as the game's going on. So Ottawa plays Nashville on Thursday night. It's the last game before the Christmas break, before playing against Pittsburgh on Boxing Day. Today at practice, Alexei Kovalev demoted again to the fourth line by Corey Kloosten. Is this going to be an ongoing process where we need to send this guy a message every week? Or how long is this going to run its course before we just finally say, you know what, enough's enough. We're going to send you home like Bob Gainey did in Montreal.
What message are we sending this guy?
Oh, he's a mercenary. He doesn't care. He's getting paid.
What message are we sending this guy?
Last time this happened, he publicly acknowledged that it's not him, right? He's had this. He's been stigmatized.
He is, since, though. Since that's day the thing. One, that's, into the league. Like, he puts up points. I mean, not scoring a goal a shift, you demote him to the fourth line because he's talented enough to? It makes no sense.
No, but his effort sucks. But that hasn't changed since day one.
That's
right?
The way he's always played the game, though. Like, he's a type of guy who he's a patient player. He's sort of.
But that's the thing. We're talking right now about Kovalev, and I think at this point it's too far gone. The situation's too far gone, and someone's going to pick this guy up. And it kind of lends itself to what Klusin's doing right now by sending him a message. Somebody in this league will be dumb enough to pick him up and think that they can change him and invoke this effort and passion
of
that
course.
This heartless bastard can't bring to the ice on a fucking nightly basis. You know? And it's just, there's some fucking guy who has the audacity and fucking ego on them to think that they can bring out the best in this guy. And it's not going to happen. But someone will be dumb enough to take him off our hands.
Yeah, probably. But Kalustin's not doing us any favors in creating a market for this guy by playing him on the fourth line, limiting his ice time, and not playing him on the power play.
Exactly. So are you concerned that he is actually back on the fourth line?
Yeah.
It's not going to send him a message. Like, let's get real here.
No, it's not going to send him a message. He's played the game the same way his entire career.
Do you think he's
one of those guys that you can tell within his first three shifts of a hockey game whether his head's going to be in it or not. And there's some nights he'll be great, and there's other nights he'll just check out. Maybe I was comparing someone else to him, but he's one of these guys. It's just like there's no connection between like his brain and his body or something. Like he's just
no. He has a pilot's license. He doesn't give a shit.
He can do anything.
Parades around the dressing room like it's a cop badge.
I don't often drink beer, but when I do. I prefer Dos Equis.
Getting back to his trade value, if he still has any at this point.
I think he does. I think he does. He does.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe some team will be dumb enough to take him on. But is this a situation where you might have to wait until the trade deadline to get rid of this guy?
Most likely.
Do you think Ottawa will be a seller before that point? Not even with just Kovalev, though, but with other players on the team?
No, because I'm supremely confident in the management and coaching of this team, and I think that we can turn things around and make a run. I think we're going to be buyers.
Some people do believe that we can take a run, though. Bruce Garriott, in yesterday's digital face-off on the Ottawa Sun's paper, said that there was still time to turn this around.
And oh, man.
I'm looking at the statistics of probabilities.
What planet is he on? What games is he watching?
I don't get it. I don't get it, man. I honestly don't get it.
We are so far out of the picture right now. It's not even like...
Well, it's at 2%. Right now, according to the sportsclubstats.com, it's at 2%, which is less than the statistical probability that Eklund will get one of his trade rumors right. So
yeah.
Put that in perspective.
Exactly.
I think it's like the faster that we acknowledge where we are in relation to the rest of the teams in this league, in the sense that we have games in hand, and teams are going to catch us for where we are in the standings. And right now, I think our positions in the standings flatter us right now. And
well, yeah, because we've played... if you compare us to, say, a team like the Rangers, who's played about the same amount of games, what are the Rangers, fifth in the conference?
Yeah, something like that.
So, man, eighth is 6-7 points ahead of us. The Rangers are at least a dozen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think eighth place is Boston right now.
Boston's in eighth.
So,
and to think that, I mean, like, even on, like, they, Tim Thomas is the front runner for the Vezina Trophy this year. They have a former Norris winning trophy defenseman in Zdeno Chara. They're deep down the middle. I mean, like, to even think we have a hope in hell of closing the gap on Boston is so unrealistic. And then you have Carolina in ninth. Again, way better on paper than we are. What planet are these people living on? And I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. Like, what planet are people that think we can climb back in the playoff picture are living on?
I don't get it.
No, I'm not. And I think maybe he's just trying to put a positive spin on it, right? I think that's probably what he's trying to do. And I'm not saying. I mean, we've had Bruce on the podcast here before. He's great. He's been a great interview. He's been a very insightful guest. Everyone who thinks that there's still a chance really needs to give their head a shake.
It's not looking good. So, Francois, I can tell that the smile has left your face now that we've kind of hashed on the Senators for about 20 minutes now. How about we switch gears and call our next guest, who will come on and talk a little junior hockey with us, put us in a little bit of a holiday spirit, something to look forward to starting on Boxing Day. So how about we come back with Nate Sager from Buzzing the Net, a Yahoo Sports junior hockey blog, and, yeah, we'll talk a little junior hockey.
Yeah, that sounds good. Let's
All right,
do it.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I've been dancing on this killing floor for years. Of the few things I am certain, the captain of my burden. I'm sorry, dog, I could never stop the rain.
Welcome back, listeners. We're joined on the line by Nate Sager. Nate, welcome to the program. How are you?
Not too bad, Graham. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Francois and I were looking forward to talking to you at this time of year. It's going to be good talking a little junior hockey with you. So, Nate, I couldn't help but read one of the articles that you had written this morning, and it pertained to, was it a lawyer who drafted a contract?
Yeah, it was a hockey dad who happened to be a lawyer. It wasn't so much he drafted a contract as, I guess, I might have misworded it, but then again, I hadn't had my coffee yet. basically, coach of a Pee Wee A team, which I guess is one of the lower levels of rep hockey, and they had a player on the team last month, and he drafted up an agenda saying he wanted to keep one player on the team from getting playing defense and ever playing on the power play or in penalty kill situations. And I guess it got out, and I mean, the player who happened to be the only girl on the team ended up eventually quitting the team and going to play on an all-girls team. Just a story where you wonder, like, I'm not sure what more to be offended by. I think the real offensive part is that someone would use his, hard-won by lawyering skills to publicly humiliate a 12-year-old. I mean, that's, I think, the real shameful part.
Yeah, what a hack, eh?
Yeah. it's like, okay, buddy, yes, we see you got the law degree on your wall.
but I noticed at the end of the article that he did say, he did have a little footnote at the end of it saying that there were a couple of close incidents inside the locker room, though.
Yeah, but he was trying to say it wasn't sexism. And I mean, I was honestly floored by that. I mean, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, Hicksville, Canada, and I mean, up till the time I was well into my teens, we always, you're playing house league hockey or, softball in the summer, you always had a girl or two in the league or on your team, and I don't remember it ever being an issue. I mean, common sense usually ruled the day, if they could find like a, separate change room and or whatever, I seem to remember that there was a Tim Hortons commercial along that theme at one time, wasn't there?
Yeah, with the guy who's been, I think, like, he's working at that small town rink for, basically his whole life, and he created that little dressing room out of, milk crates for a bench and whatnot for the one girl that played on the team. I know exactly. It probably should be airing very soon. Usually around Christmas time, they throw it on to make people go.
Yeah, along with the giving my picture back guy.
So, Nate, this is kind of like the second minor hockey league story that's kind of come out that's kind of been a little bit controversial. Well, not really a little bit. It's a lot. It's a lot controversial. Did you want to maybe address the other recent incident that I'm talking about or referring to?
Yeah, the Greg Walsh story in Peterborough. And that was just, again, you're just like, what causes people to just lose perspective and not be able to step back and see these things for as silly as they are? And I mean, that one, of course, I don't know if it made Hockey Night in Canada, but certainly got around. I think it was about a midget house league game where, two boys were in the penalty box. One of them, I think, is biracial, and the other kid used a racial slur on him. The referees didn't hear it, the timekeepers did. And of course, what happens is, the player who dropped, what quote unquote the N word. I mean, I hate that term, but it is what it is. Ends up, only sitting out a period. One coach, the coach of the, boy, I'm trying to, the coach of the one boy, Andrew McCollum being the player who was, sort of abused that way. His coach, Greg Walsh, pulls his team off the ice, forfeits the game, which now under Hockey Canada rules, if you fail to start play, the rule is you may be suspended for up to a year. They suspended him. I mean, it's conditional there. I mean, this was an exceptional circumstance. And I think, thankfully, the outcry owned about the Ontario Minor Hockey Association did eventually reinstate him. And, I mean, was that the best way to go about showing your disgust with the opposing coach for not benching his player for the rest of the game? Maybe not. Maybe it was something where you could have finished the game and then immediately taken it up with the league. Because, no child should have be subject to that for just trying to play hockey. I mean, it's, you know, it's just embarrassing. And I'm saying this as someone who, you know, played in the OMHA as a kid for 12 years. I mean, it was just like, oh my God, like, where is your sense of decency here?
Yeah, I mean, some of these stories come out, and it's definitely not the first types of stories along these lines where you kind of scratch your head and you go, what planet are these people living on? And why is it, do you think, that in Canada, and it may be like this in other places, but it seems like in Canada, we have these stories all over minor hockey that are sometimes have a really negative sort of connotation. Like, what is it about the way Canadian minor hockey, the way it's organized, in your opinion, that leads to having these stories come out every so often?
I guess people just, maybe it's, with, the cost of playing, people have more of a sense of entitlement that they should be able to demand this or demand that, we all know from, youth sports, there's always the type of people who get involved with organizing with them because, it's their little power trip or whatever, but and then obviously in this case, it was just, I think in the OMHA's case of suspending the coach, they clearly didn't understand that there was some discretion. I think John Gregg at the Hockey News had a great saying, but the thing about power is you have the discretion not to use it. And Bruce Arthur also pointed out, the way it's worded, it says you may be suspended, and they thought it meant you an automatic suspension, which is something completely different. And it is too bad. It's a hilarious. It's just hilariously ironic how bad this turned out. And it's kind of funny. If you look at the OMHA, maybe it's something where they hadn't really considered these diversity issues. And I can definitely relate it back to something, a friend of mine named Dwayne Rollins, who actually covers Major League Soccer now, when he was working at a small town paper in Southern Ontario near Six Nations, there were some similar incidents like that during OMHA playdowns where the kids playing for Six Nations who are, obviously Aboriginal. We had instances where they were, being like taunted and had beer poured into their bench. Just no one from in a position of power in minor hockey seemed equipped to deal with it. He came away with thinking like that, that the issue of diversity and what Canada's like in the 21st century just has not crossed their mind. It's kind of like they're just trying to deal with it on their own terms. And maybe that's too much to expect from people in a largely volunteer organization, but it's obvious that these problems are going to come up from time to time.
I think it kind of lends itself to a lot of parents want their kids to play like the highest competitive level possible, even if it's like the lowest division in the league. It reminds me of that story from, I think it was like last year or 2 years ago, where there was a kid in minor baseball whose coach instructed him not to pitch to one hitter because he had a better matchup facing the disabled kid who was batting on, who was in the on deck circle. And it's just a joke. I'm not one of those persons who says, yeah, the whole object of sports is just to have fun at the minor league level. But like you have to place some level of value on competition. But it's gotten to the point where some parents are just like completely with their expectations of where their kids could go.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is that, Graham, that sort of segues into what I always do end up sort of feeling bad for the people who, commit these blunders because, it gets passed around, it makes Deadspin, it makes FARC, and then, with the way things are now, I'm sure the lawyer guy there in Toronto, George Addis, is probably just getting bombarded with all sorts of rude emails. I mean, all I did was write one post on it today, and I've already had about 10, which is about, 10 times as many emails as I generally get in a day for things I've written for Yahoo Canada. So, but yeah, I mean, it's just at some point, people do lose sight of it. I mean, obviously it's fun to play a game and get better at it and improve your people skills. And I think winning makes that all the more fun. I mean, I was never any kind of serious athlete, but I can tell you I had more fun on the teams I played on that were competitive and won games at the level that they were at than I did playing for teams that lost almost every game. That's for sure. I mean, let's be completely honest here. But at some point, you just got to realize that, at the end of the day, it is sort of about people learning to get along and, get better at something together. And if that ends up that you're ahead on the scoreboard more often than not, then, so be it. I mean, 99.999% of kids playing minor hockey are not going to be in the NHL, let's be quite honest.
Yeah, I think that the only time I'd be cool with a bunch of parents getting together to determine ice time was if, like, the fathers who accompanied the Senators on their most recent road trip got together and said, yeah, Alexei Kovalev, yeah, we're going to limit your ice time, buddy. There's nothing you can do about it. We're putting the foot down.
Yeah, but I think you did sort of lead me around. Maybe that does come back to how expensive minor hockey is now. Like,
yeah, that's true, too. That's a good point.
Just had no... He's like, hey, I'm paying, you know, $3,000 a year for my kid to play. I should be able to, you know, organize a meeting and try to get this one child's ice time reduced. And I didn't see it as a gendered thing, really. I mean, I think it got more attention because it was a girl, but I mean, it would be just as wrong if you did that to a 12-year-old boy.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe just to switch up gears and focus on a little bit more positive aspects of junior hockey. The World Juniors commence on Boxing Day. I believe, who does Canada start up against? Is it Sweden?
Canada versus Russia. 3:30 on, probably 4, closer to 4 p.m. on Boxing Day.
I was reading one of your quick hits columns today on your blog, and you had one Keith Alang quote, and he came out and said, someone told me Canada had 15 first-round draft picks on their roster this year. I don't know why Canada should be considered an underdog in this tournament. As the defending champions, should the Americans be the favorite, or is this just a ploy by a coach who's has a lot of pressure on him because this tournament is being played in Buffalo?
Yeah, it was a little bit of gamesmanship. That was actually from a question Randy, I think, was one of the only Canadian reporters actually on the call. Randy Starkman from the Toronto Star had asked a question, well, what do you think about Canada calling itself a lunch bucket crew? And he's like, well, I can't get inside anyone's head. And then he said the part that you just quoted there. So it definitely, I think it is sort of a bit of a soft sell on Team Canada's part, sort of played out, and they're trying to go with this whole sort of no superstars motif. And you kind of wonder if they really are trying to sort of steal people for the fact that, hey, you know, we might not win. You know, because I think the people in Canada have sort of gotten conditioned to, you know, gold or nothing. And that, by the same token, I still do think the U.S. is the favorite when you look at how much experience they have in this tournament, and they're at home, and they definitely have some, you know, firepower up front. I think the big thing that determines this team's success in this tournament is having some forwards who can sort of create something for themselves on the offensive end, you know, shake free, win the one-on-one matchups, you know, find a little crease in the defensive zone coverage and blast away, you know. And that's definitely guys like Jeremy Morin and Kyle Palmieri on the U.S. team. So I would make the U.S. definitely a favorite in this tournament, but I think Sweden, Russia, Canada, it's going to be a competitive one for sure.
One of the things that's kind of been interesting with Team Canada's in the recent past is they always seem to try and have a good amount of grinders. We've seen players like Patrice Cormier and
Steve Downey,
and those type of players have always played a prominent role on the Canada junior teams. And we've seen some very talented, by all accounts, 17-year-olds get sent home, such as Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. Do you think that that Canada philosophy when picking junior teams of having those grinders is something effective, or how would you assess sort of the makeup of Team Canada as is versus what it could have been if they would have taken maybe some of the more younger, inexperienced players, yet maybe more talented players?
Yeah, it gets into the whole correlation causation thing. I mean, Canada's always going to be deep enough to be competitive at this tournament, and I think it's like a perpetual cycle, right? I mean, they sit there and say, well, okay, we'll take, you know, these grinders, you know, like a Downey or Stefan Della Rovere the last couple of years, you know, Stefan Lajan, you know, Casey Zizekas and Marcus Foligno are instances of that archetype this year. And I mean, if they're successful with it once, they're like, keep thinking, well, we'll be successful with it again. But at some point, you know, in hockey, the best defense is always going to be the best offense. So, I mean, at some point that's going to catch up to them. And I mean, if this is the year, a lot of people are, if this does turn out to be a year where that happens, I think a lot of people are going to be saying, like, I told you so. I mean, people are saying, like, man, Canada almost went over its way to avoid taking any snipers. Definitely see that with, you know, Tyler Toffoli from the Ottawa 67s doesn't even get a shot at the invite camp, and he's like one of the leading goal scorers in the entire Canadian Hockey League. I'm not saying he would have made the team, and I'm not saying he would necessarily make it next year, but I mean, that's sort of striking. I mean, a guy who can score in the OHL consistently can probably do it at that tournament too. But it's definitely just neat the way they go about it, but it's kind of like they want to believe that, well, we've got this great, you know, Canadian work ethic, and that'll be enough. But eventually it usually does, you know, heart might decide games, but you definitely need talent to be in the mix. And sometimes I wonder if it's counterproductive to, you know, sort of load up on the grinders. But again, you never know in a short tournament.
Do you think it's kind of reminiscent to some of those teams that were selected by Wayne Gretzky, those Olympic teams in the early?
Dammer.
Yeah, exactly. And guys like
Shane Corson.
Draper Malpe, and Corson. Yeah, great examples.
Yeah, it's like this like sort of deifying of the guy who gets 12 goals and 35 points a season.
It's almost like Canadians are so insecure about their hockey identity that we feel we need to have like that grinder presence, sort of we're going to be more physical and we're going to outwork everybody. But from a skill standpoint, we're just as skilled as everybody else. Yet it's like it almost you get that sense that the brain trust of these teams feels like if they're bringing a team that's too skilled to the mix, it's like they're playing the other people's game or something.
Yeah. But at the same time, they pretty much are playing the other people's game because they are building a team that can stop the U.S. instead of building a team that the U.S. has to stop.
No, that's a fantastic point. So, Nate, you mentioned Toffoli as a notable omission from the camp selection process. Are there any other notable names or players who you would have liked to have seen have an extended look or a better chance to make this team?
Well, I mean, I obviously can't put myself in the, you know, Dave Cameron and Kevin Prendergast. And Brendan Ranford is a, you know, he was leading the WHL in goals when the camp selection camp roster was announced. He didn't get invited. And Ryan House, who's, you know, the prospect the Calgary Flames just signed on Tuesday. I mean, he was having a terrific season in the WHL, and he was let go. Joey Hishon, you know, the Colorado Avalanche first-round pick who plays in Owen Sound. I mean, those are ones that seem to be coming up, and just from guys who actually did get to the camp and got down right down to the end, a lot of people were like, well, how did Ryan Murphy, you know, not get a chance? I mean, this guy's going to have 100 points in the OHL as a defenseman at age 17. And I mean, and then you saw like how Canada was on the power play on Tuesday night against Sweden, you know, 1-for-10, and the one goal was 5-on-3, and they've got a forward playing point. So how could they not think that Ryan Murphy would help? I mean, his defense is what it is, but, you know, so is PK Subban's for two world juniors.
One of the other things I find interesting about Team Canada is really since Carey Price, it seems like most of the iterations of Team Canada haven't really had sort of a highly touted goaltender going into the tournament. And we've seen a number of highly touted goaltenders for other teams, Al Montoya, Markstrom, Robin Lehner for Sweden. So can you just maybe give us your insight as to the goaltending situation for Team Canada heading into this year's tournament?
I don't know if they've got a clear-cut number one. Like Mark Vizintin from the Niagara Ice Dogs is the Phoenix, who was the first Canadian goalie taken in the June draft by the Phoenix Coyotes. He sort of got there a year ahead of schedule. I don't know if people really saw him being at this level just yet, but I mean, he's sort of that classic, you know, really smart, headsy type of goaltender who's very technically sound. Is always very well positioned, and you know he's having a terrific season with Niagara, who isn't in the official CHL top 10, but our rankings at Yahoo have them fourth in the entire CHL. And Olivier Roy, I think what was the determining factor in him making the team was he was the only 19-year-old goalie at camp. And I mean, people say he's sort of a guy who sort of rises to the occasion. I mean, he sort of, you know, his numbers in the Quebec League this year aren't great. I think he was only eighth in save percentage. And typically, like, I mean, you look at other goalies, I mean, who've been really good for Canada at that tournament, whether it was Price or Steve Mason, they were usually top five in their leagues. He definitely played a great game against Sweden. I think he might be a slight favorite just because he's a little older than, because he is you know, 1 year ahead, that he might be a slight favorite to at least get the first crack at it. Vizintin really changed too much. But I guess the game against Finland, is the last exhibition game, is going to probably give us a better indication of who starts against Russia on Boxing Day. But I don't think the goaltending is going to be a problem, but it's probably not going to be, you know, the best goaltending at the tournament. I think that's probably Sweden with Lehner.
So, Nate, a little while ago, you mentioned Ryan Murphy as a notable omission on defense. One of Ottawa's top prospects, Jared Cowan, he's going to have a bigger role this year. He didn't really have an impressive tournament last year. He was benched in the Switzerland semifinal game before coming on to play a more frequent role against the Americans in the gold medal game. But how critical is this tournament for him, and just in terms of his confidence and his development?
I think it will be a good reflection of, you know, how far Jared Cowan has come. I mean, he's having a terrific year for Spokane in the Western Hockey League. I mean, he was coming off, I guess, a knee surgery there before the tournament. I think that maybe affected his confidence, or maybe cost him a split second of quickness, or, well, I mean, quickness being relative, because he's sort of a big guy. So this could really help him break out and convince the Senators organization of where he'll start next season. I mean, maybe their mind's already made up that he'll crack the big club's lineup. I mean, they definitely always could use a little more defense there on the Sen.
Oh, low blow.
Yeah, well, I've only been to one game this year, so I was at the game where Spezza threw the set up Brian Little there for the overtime winner.
Oh, very nice.
Fortunately, I was in like the second last row of like the 200 level, and you can't really, when you're in the second last row, you can't turn around and fist pump people.
Well, kudos to you for sticking around for the whole game.
There's just like one row, and you feel like you're singling them out.
The only downside of you actually being at the game is you weren't treated to the moment of comedy after the Brian Little goal, with Brian Murray scratching away on a piece of paper in his luxury box.
Oh, man.
And it was just so bad. Yeah, that was notable, because Spets had actually been probably the biggest reason the Senators had, you know, come back to force overtime, and then that happened.
It's fitting.
When it rains, it pours.
It's just the way the season's going, Nate. Now, before we go, we just kind of wanted to get into some quick hits with you. Do you mind sticking around for like five quick questions? Just give
sure.
us like the first thing that comes to mind when we ask you the question. Nate, you're a Leafs fan. What's your take on the waffle situation? Are you pro-waffle? Are you anti-waffle?
I am pro-waffle. I was talking about that with my dad tonight. We, you know, both of us being Leaf fans, we both thought, you know, it was just a great form of protest against LC and all that it stands for.
Do you think this will be like the start of something bigger?
It probably will fizzle out in time, but I still think it's, you know, a hilarious bit of spontaneous rebellion, against obviously an organization that's great at making profits, but not too much at putting out a good hockey team.
All right, so for the World Junior Tournament, can you quickly give us your medal picks?
I think I'm going to go U.S., Canada, Sweden.
Do you have a dark horse team for the tournament?
In terms of like someone who's been, I think the Finns, there seems to be a lot of buzz around Finland, and you know, they're probably going to be, I mean, because of the way the tournament shook out last year, they're in that pool with Team USA. It's a little bit easier on that side. I mean, maybe they'll be a little more rest to have a little more tank once they get into the semifinals.
Who do you think will end up being the number one pick in the NHL entry draft 2011?
I think I'm leaning a bit towards Gabriel Landeskog, just because if you're going with the principle that the number one pick is the guy who's going to be most ready to play in the league, because that's, because there's this win now mentality in the NHL, it might be Landeskog. Turier is probably will be it, but I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that Landeskog is in that same vein, though.
Yeah.
Third-year junior player who's pretty developed.
Yeah, I find just browsing around like the prospect boards and a number of websites that he's one of the names out there who's garnering a lot of attention and has a lot of buzz to his name right now. Are there any other guys of note that you would say are making the ascent up your prospect rankings, or guys that we can keep an eye on?
Well, in the OHL, someone who I think is really starting to sneak up into the top 10, or if he hasn't been there already, is Ryan Strom from the Niagara Ice Dogs.
Yeah.
And he's just got, unbelievable just hockey sense and vision and, and terrific hands. He's a 17-year-old winger, and he runs the plays in Niagara. I mean, that's how far developed. I mean, he's still on the small side, but, he could almost be like this year's Jeff. I think he could be like this year's Jeff Skinner, the guy who might not be high on the central scouting list, but someone might take him in the top 10 and, fast track him to the NHL very, very quickly. Another guy I think people should be keeping an eye on from the Western Hockey League, at least, maybe I'm going a little far afield, Mark McNeil in Prince Albert's having a terrific season. He was he's a kid who's putting up a lot of points for the Prince Albert Raiders, a team that doesn't get a lot of attention. I believe back in the Bantam draft a few years ago, he was like the fifth overall pick, but you know how it often happens with the Bantam draft or the midget draft. It's the flashy little centerman who scored, a bazillion points in AAA hockey, who sort of get noticed a little more, and the power forwards tend to slide down the board a bit. But he's someone who's definitely come on strong. It's going to be probably a good draft here for the WHL between Ryan Nugent Hopkins and Ty Ratty, and from the Portland Winterhawks, who's just absolute. They went 1-2 in the Bantam draft 3 years ago. And even a kid like Michael St. Croix from the Edmonton Oil Kings. So I'm just plugging him because I profiled him last week.
Nice. Last question for you. Adam Larson was a guy who kind of came into this year's draft as a defensive prospect who had a lot of buzz, but he seems to be kind of slipping on some of the draft boards that I've seen. Is this a case of a prospect who was highly touted and we're all kind of like looking for reasons to kind of like find holes in his game? Or is this just a case of a guy who's not really having that impressive of a season over in Sweden?
Yeah, it's tough to say with defensemen because, the wow factor isn't always there with a two-way defenseman as much as it is with, a center or even an offensive defenseman. So I think at the end of the day, he's still going to end up fairly high. I mean, it kind of went the same way with Victor Hedman 2 years ago, didn't it? I mean, everyone was kind of like, well, what's so special about this guy? And yet there he was, come draft day. He still went, I believe, in the top three, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Nate, on behalf of Francois and I, just thank you for coming on the podcast, talking a little World Junior Hockey with us. What do you have coming up on your blog this week?
Well, I guess we'll be pretty heavy into some team capsules, so... I think we're going to finally try to get it across to people that Philip Grubauer and Hans Gruber from Die Hard basically sound exactly the same.
Fantastic. Well, Nate, enjoy the tournament. Thanks for coming on, and we'll try and have you on after the tournament's over to give us a little...
All right. Thank you, Graham. Thank you, Francois.
Thanks for your time. Take care. So that was pretty interesting. It's nice to get a little insider analysis before the start of the World Junior Tournament going on next week. One of the names you mentioned was Ryan Strome, who you just pulled up one of the websites. I believe it was
MyNHLDraft.com.
And they had Strome actually sliding into the Senators right now at the number 7 slot.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
Encouraging, I think.
Until you look at his size and you see, 5'11", 160?
5'11", 160 pounds of pure twisted steel. I was watching some of his highlight videos, though. Yeah, he can skate. He's got sick hands. Good awareness, anyways. It seems like the videos are representative of what Nate was telling us about Ryan Strome. So it is a little bit encouraging. And the nice thing is he's a forward, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a drafted forward.
It would be. A skilled forward.
I'm still a little bit of a take the best player available, regardless of position guy.
Yeah, definitely. Though it seems, based on this mock draft, that in that 5-9 pick area that the Senators are sitting in right now, it's mostly forwards to be had. So
cross your fingers, boys and girls.
Yeah.
So getting back to the Senators, Francois, one of the things I wanted to hit on before we left tonight was the speculation coming out of Calgary. Now that their team is on the decline.
What?
Looks like they're already bottomed out.
Calgary's on the decline?
Don't tell the Senators that. Who knows what's going on there? That's a situation where some of the experts over at ESPN, I think it was Pierre LeBrun and Scott Burnside, were talking about how the organization has to trade Jerome Iginla to start the rebuild process in Calgary. There's been a lot of talk also coming from New Jersey that the Devils might parlay a Martin Brodeur for assets of their own. A number of these teams towards the bottom of the standings look like they could be sellers heading towards the NHL trade deadline. Do you think this kind of puts maybe an impetus on Ottawa to look more critically at their roster and start wondering, what if we start moving some of the guys who maybe have been here for a while?
Yeah, as hard as it might be to do. And actually, it's really interesting. I was talking to a friend the other day, a good friend of mine, and he's a pretty big Senators fan, and we got into the whole Chris Phillips issue. And one of the things at first he was saying was, he's like, you know, I think it's important for us to have a couple of guys stay with the retire with the organization, right? And it goes back to that whole trying to build some sort of
legacy, an identity, history, a race, culture. Yeah,
exactly. And
stuff
then I told
hate.
Him exactly. And then like we got more into that, and I said to him like, well, but that's just, the team's only been around for 20 years. Like, that stuff does happen. It just, you can't force it, right? Like, it happens naturally. Like, Alfredson in a perfect world would have, if they would have done certain things from a managerial standpoint, probably Alfredson would have had another opportunity at a Stanley Cup run and retired with this team. Now things are kind of in limbo, and we might be looking at a situation where Daniel Alfredson is prepared to go elsewhere for a chance to win a Stanley Cup, and we might be in a position to get some really nice pieces back for him. So I think it's definitely something we seriously have to start to consider. Not only trying to get the most value out of guys like Kovalev, but is someone like Milan Mikolic, with four knee surgeries and 3 years left on his contract, with
contract.
Not a lick of natural goal scoring ability, is that someone we want to move forward with in this organization? Right,
and I think it gets even worse when you look at his contract status and you realize, holy shit, this guy signed here till, I believe, what, 2013, the 14 season, where he's making $6 million in his last year with the organization.
Yeah, like, his cap hit it's pretty high for a guy that is. Has no natural goal scoring ability whatsoever.
I think he still has enough name recognition wherein he still has some value attached to his name. But I think if you had to rebuild Ottawa, he is the first guy who has to go because of his contract, his lack of production, and where this team is headed.
Yeah, but he's not the type of player that you would ever say is a core player on any team he's on. He's a very good supporting cast type player on a really good team, and I agree with you. I think Milan Mikolic is exactly the type of player that would be very attractive to a contending team, say Pittsburgh, or someone who on a very good team could fit in nicely to a top six role, kill penalties, power play, etc. But he's not really someone that you use to build a team with if you're executing a rebuild.
No, he's a complimentary piece. Chris Phillips and Daniel Alfredson are similar in the sense that they have been here since the formative years of this franchise. Alfredson and Phillips have taken reduced salaries to stay with this organization. Alfredson in particular has deferred salary during the bankruptcy years to ensure that the Senators could afford to take on some ex-salary to augment their roster. I'm of the opinion that if Alfredson wanted to stay, fine, he deserves that. He's done enough for this franchise. He's taken pay cuts to remain here in Ottawa. If he wants to stay, fine. But Chris Phillips is young. He still has many years left in the NHL.
Many? Or?
Well, he's 32.
Yeah, okay, so a few.
So
yeah,
he still has time to play. I'm not as loyal to Phillips as I am to Alfredson. So if Phillips can be moved, I would seriously consider doing that.
Yeah, because they weren't loyal to Anton Volchenkov, who had been here from the outset of his career. And Volchenkov was younger, arguably better than Phillips. So to say that Volchenkov wasn't really part of the picture moving forward, and then to turn around to say Chris Phillips, who's older, shittier, is part of the plan moving forward, it's very counterintuitive.
It's just it's a complete about face, right? I can understand the circumstance of why you wouldn't sign a guy like Volchenkov, but to turn around and sign Chris Phillips, yeah, absolutely, I agree with you. I think it'd be a mixed message that you're completely
sending the
franchise.
It would be strictly for sentimental reasons. It lacks complete business sense to bring back Chris Phillips. Now, if he's willing to accept a reduced role on this team and play for $1.5 million, which I don't think he's willing to do at all, because I think that some other team would probably offer him slightly more money than that, okay, I can live with that because he's not killing the salary structure or anything like that. But any contract where the cap hit is anything close to what he's getting right now is ludicrous. It's ludicrous.
I agree with you. All right. So if Ottawa were to say that they had to rebuild, who are the five guys at the top of your list who you'd move?
I think Mahalik's number one just because his contract would be an albatross. I think Number two, if in the event you could move him, again, I think you'd seriously want to consider moving Mike Fisher because of his contract. I think Kuba, Phillips, and then I'm not saying I want to move him, but if he wants to go, because I think we could still get a mint for him, I think number five would be Alfredson.
I would put Ruutu in there, probably over Alfredson, but yeah, I can.
At you're this not going to get much for Ruutu, like if you're talking rebuild standpoint, Alfredson's willing to go, that's the only reason I'm putting him in that top five thing. Not saying he should ever be in the top five players of the highest priority to get off the roster. It's just that given the circumstances.
Yeah. I think that's the most depressing part of this season is that with such a veteran laden lineup that's underachieving, the number of possibilities that you can move on this team are limitless. Yeah. Really. But yeah.
The problem is
people
are going to have to give their heads a shake.
No.
And they're going to have to realize
it'll take a fair assessment.
You're going to have to realize that you're probably going to have to take 60 cents on the dollar. From an NHL ready standpoint, to get rid of most of these guys, but you have to treat it as clearing up some salary, getting your salary structure reorganized, and moving forward, building through the draft and whatnot.
What's the first step in a rehabilitation program? I think it's admitting that you have a problem.
Exactly.
I wonder if the Senators are there yet. Eugene Melnyk's been awfully quiet, so we'll see. We'll see how the next few weeks unfold, especially when the NHL roster freezes.
I can't wait till the next time Melnyk gets in front of a microphone. It's either going to be a firing or a soundbite for the ages.
Anyways, I think that wraps it up for another edition of the Sixth Sense Podcast. Francois, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. Same goes to you, listeners. Thanks for sticking with us. I think we'll try and get another podcast in before the new year. Maybe on the I think it's the 30th. 29th or 30th that we'll try and get back in here. But thank you again for such a wonderful, wonderful year at the Sixth Sense, and forward to the new year.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for listening.
Always a pleasure. Thanks
for
listening.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Nice to see you again. Talk some hockey. But thanks, listeners. Catch you hopefully next week. Take care.